Nashville Convention is one of the highlights of the year.
We bring the warm Christian love and greetings, especially of Janet and Obi, and of the whole class, those that are left behind from New Brunswick. Our discussion this morning will be in a prophetic nature, and we hope to get into some devotional aspects that are related and should be related. Thank you. And I don't think anybody has the last word on prophecy. Certainly I don't. So we'll just say that what we do offer is in the spirit of dialogue. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on the things that have been or will be presented. Okay, our scripture or our subject is taken from the words of Jesus, Lord's great prophecy, Luke 21:28. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up, lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. He was referring especially to all of the signs that would come upon the earth, conditions that would come upon the earth that were in our Lord's great prophecy. And we feel that we've been seeing these signs since 1874, and the further we extend, the more signs, the more evidences we see of the Lord's hand. Our King is marching on the Lord's hand in the affairs of men as he's setting up his kingdom. But I think all of us, we're just overwhelmed with the events that began to start taking place, say, about December of 89. Then the complete collapse of communism in Russia and the Eastern European nations. And we started thinking in terms of, well, you know, the disarmament, they're saying peace and safety. And then there's going to be sudden destruction, and before you know what happened. The peace and safety period came to an end very quickly. And we have a mass military array in the Middle East. And war could be very imminent. You know, things are so startling that we've never seen this before, seemingly. On television, we watch people, masses march, demonstrate, and nations fall before our eyes in a matter of weeks. Unbelievable. Where do we stand on the stream of time? Well, just a word of caution before. I think most of the brethren are saying, well, you know, with everything that's going on, the end can't be far, you know. It has to be around the corner. This is the finale of things. And I'm inclined to agree. But just a word of caution. Our lives don't extend back to other times the Harvest Church has faced almost parallel situations. Think of the Hague Peace Conference. What was it, 1912, 1913? And they assured peace. Then 1914, the outbreak of World War I, at the time that the times of the Gentiles ended. The Bible student movement was ecstatic. This was it. This had to be it. Then World War II. In the North African campaign, and Rommel heading for Egypt and the Middle East, and the allied nations trying to prevent that. And all of the brothers are saying, all the nations are being gathered to the Middle East, to Armageddon. And they thought the end was there. So we're just giving these as words of caution. We are seeing very startling, phenomenal events. And I feel that they indicate that the end is very near. But let's keep our feet on the ground as well as our heads in the clouds. First, in a very general, quick way, the vision given to Elijah at Mount Hor consisted of the wind, the earthquake, and the fire. Brother Russell suggested that these represent three stages of the time of trouble: the wind, the war stage, the earthquake, the revolutionary stage, and the fire, the anarchy stage. I did have a pointer in my pocket here someplace. Okay. So we feel that the war stage began with 1914 and World War I. And it continued on. You had World War II someplace along the way. That was the continuation of the war stage. But we feel that the revolutionary stage began in 1917 with the Communist Revolution. And communism swept over one-third of the world. And where you didn't have communism, you had socialism and you had left-of-center government. Brother Russell predicted that the revolutionary stage would take place in this country by the ballot, peacefully. And it did. You had a welfare state, and you have a welfare state in this country. So we feel, without going into greater details, that the revolutionary stage began, of Elijah's vision, began in 1918, 1917, and is continuing on. We feel that there are specific revolution pictures in the scriptures that zero in on a particular phase of the revolutionary stage. We feel that the revolution of Revelation 16, I know you can't read it, but you're getting my time points by just this timeline here and where I'm pointing. The revolutionary stage of Elijah's vision, we feel, began in 1917. But the revolution of Revelation 16, in which Babylon is destroyed, we feel is a future event that takes place after Babylon comes to power. And that revolutionary stage will quickly disintegrate into that revolution, rather, of Revelation 16, which, by the way, is spoken of as a revolution such as never was before, showing that there were previous revolutions. That revolution will quickly disintegrate into the anarchy stage. Okay, then we feel that the little flock will be taken, the great company will be dealt with after Babylon falls, and the invasion of Gog will take place. And there is actually a further revolution in Ezekiel 38, which we might or might not get time to go into, which Brother Russell speaks of as finishing the revolution of Revelation 16, which had previously begun at the fall of Babylon. We feel that the events that have taken place in Eastern Europe indicate that Babylon's rise to power is not far off. In Revelation 17, 1, we won't take time to read it, but the Revelator is shown the destruction, or rather the doom of Babylon, the judgment of Babylon. The word judgment there could be translated doom. And where is Babylon at the time that her doom is to come? She's sitting on many waters in Revelation 17, 1. Verse 15 identifies the waters as peoples. And then we get a description of this woman, this great whore. And now she switches from sitting on waters to sitting on a scarlet-colored beast. And then the culmination is the eighth form of that beast that she's riding on when it comes out of the abyss, and the ten horns of Europe give power to that woman, or rather to the beast, and the woman's riding on that eighth form of the beast. And we feel that this will be a people's form of government. The beast is not an eighth head. It doesn't speak of it as an eighth head. It speaks of seven heads before that, but then it speaks of the eighth as the eighth period, not an eighth head. We feel that this is the eighth form of the beast, which is the beast itself, the Roman people. And this is symbolized by the first verse: the waters that the woman sits on are equal to the beast, the Roman people, and it is a people's form of government in which Babylon and the nations of Europe give their consent to. We won't go into any further detail on that. But we just want to make one quote from Brother Russell, tying in the revolutionary stage with Babylon's rise to power. And this is reprint 5554, paragraph 8. Quote, following the terrible storm of this war will come a great revolution. Symbolically styled a great earthquake. In conjunction with this social revolution, the Bible indicates that churchianity will for a time be greatly exalted as the hoped for power by which the revolution may be offset and stopped. Now, you can't stop something before it's in existence and in motion. So he's speaking about Babylon coming to power to offset and stop the revolution. Then he goes on to say, following the revolution and churchianity's exaltation, quickly will come anarchy. Note again, it's after the revolution. After the earthquake, the revolutionary stage is well advanced, that Babylon comes to power to stop the revolution. Now, how was the communist revolution stopped? We saw it fall before our eyes. Yeah, let's see if I can get my hands on a quote around here. New York Times, April 21, 1990. A quote from Pope John Paul II. A united Europe is no longer a dream. It is not a utopian memory from the Dark Ages. The events that we are witnessing show that this goal can be reached. The Jerusalem Post, of all papers, had an article that said, Pope John Paul II, and not Gorbachev, going to bring about a united Europe. And we were just handed during the convention a clipping more recently, September 2nd, 1990, from the Indianapolis Star. Power politics, papal style, hardline pope, alarming many with a push for Christian Europe. So we feel that Christianity had a very definite part in staying the revolutionary stage, as Brother Russell predicted, to bring about a united Europe, a church-state system, and we know that the church was active in this. In Poland, it was very obvious. The Catholic Church was behind Solidarity. In East Germany, where did the youth organize? In the Protestant churches. And in Hungary, in Romania, it was the same. The revolutionary forces got their inspiration, got their encouragement from the old establishment represented by the churches. Okay, we're going to leave this for a while and hope to come into it. We're going to get into some events in Israel, and if we have time, we're dreamers. We're going to try to tie together things that are happening in Israel with the general picture of things that are going on in the world. Okay, we know that Jerusalem, and the question of Jerusalem is a big issue today in the United Nations, in the world, in the United States. There have been two UN resolutions against Israel having Jerusalem. The UN, President Bush, Secretary of State Baker speak of East Jerusalem as occupied territory, occupied by Israel. It doesn't belong to them. Do you believe that? The Bible, Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, doesn't belong to Israel? Who does it belong to? Okay, let's turn to Zechariah, the 12th chapter.
We're going to begin with verse 2 and 3. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling, all the people round about, when they shall be in siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. Notice here, Jerusalem is going to be a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. Not all the people of the world, as we're going to see in the next verse, but all the people that are round about. When they, the people round about, the Arabs, shall be in siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. Then verse 3. In that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, so all the people of the earth shall be gathered together against it. Verse 3, Jerusalem is a problem to a second group of people. All the people of the earth, in distinction to the Arabs, the people round about, in verse 2. And even though all the people of the earth be gathered against Jerusalem, which they will be in Gog's invasion, in Zechariah 14, Jerusalem will be a burdensome stone and will cut them to pieces. Okay, there are two wars, we feel, that are described later on in this chapter, and this is for your thought. There is a war that's described in verses 5 and 6 that involves the people round about. And then from verses 8 onward, it describes a further war, which we feel will be a parallel to the invasion of Gog and Magog. But reading verses 5 and 6. And the governors of Judah shall say in their hearts, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength, and the Lord of hosts their God. In that day I will make the governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of fire in a sheath. And they shall devour all the people round about, on the right hand and on the left, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. Now, when Israel took, when Israel declared her independence in 1948, and seven Arab nations marched on Israel, both and they would push the Jews into the sea, Israel fared very well in that war, except they lost the Bible of Jerusalem, which is East Jerusalem, the part that is surrounded by the wall, and also the city of David, which is outside the wall, but they lost that too, or most of it. The nation of Jordan took the Bible Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. Now, the United Nations told Israel that it had to have their capital under the UN partition plan in Tel Aviv. But if you're a Jew living in Israel, there's only one place where you can have your capital. It has to be in Jerusalem. How can you have a state of Israel without Jerusalem being your capital? It's impossible. So they said, all right, we'll make the new city of Jerusalem outside the wall, the city that's been developing since the 1880s. We'll make that our capital. But deep in their hearts, they knew that the real Jerusalem, the Bible Jerusalem, was held by Jordan. The 67 war started. Governors of Judah, the leaders of Israel, knew that if they could possess Jerusalem, this would add a religious fervor to their cause. And sure enough, Jordan joined in with Syria and Egypt, and the Israeli army just made a beeline for Jerusalem, took it in a lightning victory, and we had the remarkable phrase fulfilled in verse. And Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. It's a strange phrase, isn't it? What does it mean? Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, which was in the new city. This capital shall now occupy her own place, even in Jerusalem, in the Bible Jerusalem, which is East Jerusalem. So the capital of Israel has been in the Bible Jerusalem from 1967 onward. And the warning of verse 3 is a warning that all the leaders of the nations of the world should take heed to. And Anybody that involves themselves in the problem of Jerusalem, anybody that tries to take Jerusalem away from Israel, will find that this is a burdensome stone that will cut them to pieces. Now, you know, I come on strong at times, but I'm a little timid on prophecy, too. I'm not going to say, some brethren on the basis, they'll say, Israel will never lose Jerusalem. I'm not going to say that. If under pressure, they're forced to, it will be only temporary. Because by the time we come to the invasion of all nations gathered against Jerusalem in Zechariah 14, who's in Jerusalem? Israel's there and has Jerusalem. But I don't think, you know, that Israel will give in. I think that they will retain the old city and it belongs to them. And all the nations of the earth that trouble themselves in the Jerusalem issue will be cut to pieces. Now, there's another prophecy that is intriguing to brethren, and that's found in Psalms 83. By the way, we weren't going to speak on this subject this morning. It's just that we had so many questions and discussions on these things yesterday evening and this morning that we just decided to go into this direction. That's why we have the haphazard chart up there. Psalms 83. Keep thou not silent, O God. Hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult. They that hate thee hath lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people, and consented against thy hidden ones. Some translations say treasured ones. Actually, the thought of the Hebrew is thy protected ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, and that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consented to gather with one consent. They are confederated against thee. And who are confederated against Israel? A list of Arab nations in verses 6 and 7, which we will get into. But notice the setting here. Notice the phraseology. You know, some brethren say that the issue of Israel, like all issues in the world, kingdoms of this world, and some brethren say the nation of Israel is one of the kingdoms of this world. That's all. It just has to go like all the other nations. Brethren say, well, we shouldn't take sides. You know, we should be neutral. How neutral are these verses? There's a group of nations, Arab nations, that are gathered against Israel, that are dedicated with one purpose, to destroy Israel. They're in a confederacy. Have you ever heard of the Arab League? What is one of the main purposes of the Arab League? To eliminate this great monster, Israel. Destroy her. In verse 1, somebody's saying to the Lord, keep thou not silent, O God. Hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult. Who are the enemies who are making a tumult? Who are the enemies that say that are going against God's protected people in verse 3? Who are the enemies that say they're going to cut Israel off from the face of the earth? These enemies are the Arab nations of verse 6 and 7. This is how the scriptures speak of the nations that are arrayed against Israel. They are God's enemies. God isn't very neutral in this matter, is he? But there's a third party here. There's somebody that's praying to God that isn't Israel. They're praying on behalf of Israel, that God would save Israel from these forces that are gathered against her. And I'm just going to raise the question, and I'll leave it as a question. Who do you think this third party is that is praying to God that he protect Israel from these enemies, the Arab nations? I'll take a little step further. Who has the power of prayer? Okay, who are these enemies that are gathered against Israel? Verse 6 and 7. Well, you're not going to be able to read this at all, but at least you'll get a sense of direction and relationship to where these nations are in relationship to Israel. The tents of Edom. Okay, here's Israel right here. Here's the nation of Jordan. Here's the West Bank that jaggers into Israel proper on the west side of the Jordan River, and Jordan proper is on the east side of the Jordan River. Okay, Edom is down part of Jordan and actually extended a little into the Sinai, but it was basically more of Jordan in ancient times. Then we have Ishmael. The Ishmaelites are the Bedouin Arabs, and this is generally accepted. And the Bedouin Arabs are from Saudi Arabia, way over here. And then we have Moab. Moab is a territory that was now a part of the western part of Jordan down here. And we have the Hagarenes. And we have Gebel. And if you turn to Joshua 13:5, which we won't take time to read, you'll find that Gebel and the Gebites are the same. And Gebel is up in Lebanon. And then we have Ammon. Ammon is a little north of Moab in Jordan. And then we have the Amalekites. Let me get some scriptural references here. Now, the Amalekites, we might think on the basis of 1 Chronicles 4, 42 and 43, that they are in Jordan by Mount Seir. But I'm going to give you several scriptural citations. You can look them up, take the notes down and look them up. 1 Samuel 15, 1 through 7, and 1 Samuel chapter 30, verses 11 through 17. I think you'll find that the Amalekites are a nation that was somewhere between Egypt and Canaan, and someplace between Egypt and the Negev. And we feel that it probably does represent Egypt in this setting, because Egypt, strictly speaking, is not an Arab nation. The true-blooded Egyptians claim that they, 30% of the 33% of the people that live in Egypt are true-blooded Egyptians that haven't intermixed with the Arab race. The others have intermixed in varying degrees. So the very fact that Amalekite is a territory that's in between, I think, portrays the idea of today that the Egyptians are a mixture of Arab and Egyptian blood. But we do not feel the Amalekites are in Jordan. You'll find that in reading 1 Samuel 30, 11 through 17, 400 Amalekites escape David's destruction, and they flee. And that is when they fled to the Mount Seir area, and that is when Hezekiah destroyed them in the Mount Seir area in 1 Chronicles 4. But their original habitat, we feel, is not Jordan, but the area between Egypt and the Negev. Okay, now we have the Hagarenes. And again, I'll give a scripture. The Hagarites are mentioned in 1 Chronicles 5:10. And they are spoken of as being west of Ammon and Moab, near the wilderness of the mouth of the Euphrates. Well, the Euphrates is way over here in Iraq. So we feel that the Hagarites or Hagarenes would be someplace in western Iraq, and perhaps represent the nation Iraq. Okay, now, in verse 7, or rather verse 8, the King James says, Asher also is joined with them. They have hoped the children of Lot. Most translations say something like this. The Assyrian has also joined them. They are the strong arm of the children of Lot. And the children of Lot are Moab and Ammon. Now, when does this... Okay, who is Asher or Assyria? Because it's really Assyria in the Hebrew. We feel that Assyria is symbolic of Russia in this and other prophecies. At this stage, we're just going to suggest that we feel it's unlikely that Assyria of verse 8 is literal Assyria when it is represented by the Hagarenes of verse 6 that dwells in western Iraq. And Russia was indeed the strong arm of the Arab nations. Up to this point, Russia has provided the military might for most of the Arab nations, especially the Palestinians and Iraq and Libya and Egypt. Now, when does this war take place? Well, some feel that it's in the near future. Some feel that this is a southern attack that comes when Russia comes from the north. I'm inclined to feel that this is a continual ongoing battle. By the way, Tyre is also mentioned here, and Tyre is in Lebanon, and the Philistines are mentioned here, which we feel would be emblematic of the PLO, or the Palestinians, who are behind the Intifada. I'm inclined to feel that this is a continuing battle. Now, we're going to consider other scriptures that we feel will help to put into place, crystallize our thoughts on who Assyria is. Let's turn to Zechariah, the 10th chapter. A background scripture thought before we read Zechariah 10 is Ezekiel 20. Remember, you're well acquainted with Ezekiel 20. The Lord says that he will gathered the nations out of the land in which they were scattered, like as he gathered their fathers from the land of Egypt, and he's going to bring the Jews out of these nations into the wilderness of the people and plead with them face to face as he brought their fathers out of the wilderness, out of Egypt into the wilderness of Egypt. So the Old Testament type of the current regathering is the Exodus from Egypt. Okay, now Zechariah 10, beginning verse 9. And I will sow them among the people, that's the dispersion of Israel, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and return. And I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and a place shall not be found for them. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves of the sea, and all the depths of the river shall dry up, and the pride of the Assyrians shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. Okay, here Israel is, or rather the Jews are gathered from the nations, especially Assyria and Egypt, and they are brought into the land of Gilead. Now, the West Bank is the issue today. This is the Jordan River. Anything west of that river, of course, would be Israel, plus the West Bank is west of that river. Then east of the river is the East Bank, and the land of Gilead was east of the river, remember? 2.5 tribes occupied territory east of the Jordan River. And the land of Gilead was a part of that territory. So here there's going to be such an exodus from Assyria and Egypt that the land of Gilead and Lebanon, we feel southern Lebanon, is going to be filled. Now, are Egypt and Assyria literal in these verses? Well, we have about 400 or 500 Jews in literal Assyria, which is Iraq. And we have about 800 Jews in literal Egypt, which is Egypt. Okay. Certainly, an exodus of less than 2,000 people will not fill the land of Gilead and fill southern Lebanon. So we feel that Egypt and Assyria here are symbolic. And brethren, for a number of years now, without going into the details, have generally concluded that Assyria is symbolic of Russia. And do we have Jews in Russia? Yes and no, they're leaving fast. By the way, the latest predictions are by 1992, the end of 1992, 1 million Russian Jews will have left. And they are projecting by the 3 years later, the end of 95 or 96, the 2 million Jews from Russia will have gone to Israel. Phenomenal if it happens. And if this is the time, it will happen and it will be a miracle because the Lord will be doing it. So certainly there are Jews in symbolic Assyria, Russia, that can fill the land of Gilead and southern Lebanon. And what is Egypt here? Well, Egypt is symbolic of the world, but where in, okay, and what world is it? It's the Christian world. And where in the Christian world do we have the greatest concentration of Jews? Right here in the United States. And what's going to make them go back to Israel? Do you realize anti-Semitism in the United States? Worldwide, in fact, but in the United States, it's at an all-time high. There were more anti-Semitic acts in the United States in 1989 than any other time previously in the history of the United States. Superimposed on that, there is a continual immigration of Arabs into the United States. It's predicted that within 10 years, members of the Muslim religion, including the Arabs, will outnumber the Jews as a minority group in the United States. And these Arabs are organizing. You saw it happened at I.O. They are following the Jewish structure of lobbying and putting political pressure on the government. And they are out to minimize the influence of the Jews in the United States and to minimize the United States friendship with Israel. So we feel that the tide is going to be turning against the Jews in this country. Now, what does the sea and the river that are smitten here? Remember when the picture is the Exodus from Egypt. When the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt, they had to cross the sea to be delivered from to escape Egypt, and they had to cross a river to be delivered into the promised land. We feel those literal rivers are symbolic of the obstacles to the exodus of the Jews from Russia and the United States. The obstacles are being removed, have been removed from Russia. The laws of Russia preventing the immigration of Jews have been changed. There is great anti-Semitism in Russia. I had the privilege of being in Israel
couple weeks ago for about 12 days. We met with a number of government officials and the Russian refuseniks. And we got special permission from the government to be in the reception room at the Ben Gurion Airport to receive the Jews coming in from Russia. About 12 plane loads come in a day. And we are able to mingle with them, to ask questions, to interview them. I have recordings of our interviews. And some of the tales that they would tell you about the anti-Semitism are terrifying. This one particular girl in her 20s, she said, every day for the last 6 months, she received very vulgar and violent threatening phone calls daily from the anti-Semitic party. Several I spoke to lost their jobs because of anti-Semitism. And it was because of their fear of the nationalistic parties that are promoting anti-Semitism that they were coming to Israel. And I said, well, you might be living in tent cities here. They said, I would rather live in a tent city in Israel than with drunken anti-Semitics in Russia. Now, after this mass exodus of Jews from Russia and Egypt, the pride of the Syrians will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall be departed away. And we feel that that will happen in the invasion of Gog. So we feel that this exodus from Russia and the United States takes place before the invasion of Gog, in which Assyria, Russia is destroyed, and the Christian world, the remnants of the Christian world are fully destroyed. Okay, let's turn to Isaiah 11. Verse 11 speaks of a gathering the second time to recover the remnant of God's people. And Brother Russell makes one comment on chapter 11. It's on verse 11. He speaks of the second time gathering as a regathering that's been going on since 1878. Passing down to verse 14 and 15, there's a war in verse 14. They, Israel, shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east together. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. So here is a specific war in which Israel gains a victory over the Philistines, the Palestinians in the west, which is Gaza. And they lay their hands upon Edom and Moab and Ammon, which are territories in western Jordan, east of the Jordan River. And as a result of this war, the children of the Arabs, the children of Edom and Ammon and Moab, shall obey Israel. Here is a decisive victory over the Arabs in which the issue is decided once and for all. And then, in this connection, there's the smiting of the Egyptian sea and the river. And as a result of that smiting, there should be a highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was, this is verse 16, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Israel. Again, the parallel with the exodus from Egypt. When the antitypical sea and the antitypical rivers smitten, there's going to be an exodus from Assyria, Russia, paralleling the exodus from Egypt in olden days. We feel that it's sometime before Babylon's rise to power that there will be this exodus
from Russia and Egypt, United States. And it is sometime during this exodus that is going on that there will be the war with the Arab nations, particularly with Jordan, to get the East Bank. Israel already occupies southern Lebanon, so that the Jews from this mass exodus can overflow into this territory. Okay, now when is this war going to begin? Well, we might see it in connection with the present crisis in Iraq. Iraq has threatened to attack Israel. Israel has said, put the map down. Here's Iraq. Here's Jordan. Here's Israel. Israel said that any movement of Iraq into Jordan will mean war with, because Israel will not permit a very militant enemy against Israel to buffer, or rather to be adjacent to her borders. She wants a buffer zone between the more militant Arab nations, between her and these more militant nations, so that if Iraq moves into Jordan, that means war. We know that Iraq has threatened to attack Israel. One reason for Iraq attacking Israel, Iraq is unpopular with most of the Arab nations now. But if she attacks Israel, again, she will be the leader of the Arab nations, and they will rally around her as the great defender of the cause of Psalms 83. Or if Iraq is devastated by the United States in the near future, Saddam Hussein has threatened to attack Israel in the process to bring Israel down with himself. So this might be the stage at which Israel will go into war with the Arab nations and acquire the East Bank. If it's not, we've gone into this, I'm trying to think of the places we did, water. Shortage of water is predicted to be the reason for the next war. There's a river, the Yarmouk River, that flows from Assyria, from Syria through Jordan into Israel. Syria and Jordan are talking about diverting that water. Israel said if that water is diverted, it means war. All of the nations of the Middle East are faced with a water shortage, and it is predicted that because of this water shortage, this will be the next cause of war in the Middle East. That might be the reason or the time that Israel will acquire the East Bank. We want to turn now to Ezekiel 36. I call Ezekiel 36 the love story between the Jews and the land of Israel. Beginning with verse 3. Therefore prophesy and say, thus saith the Lord, because they have made you desolate, it's speaking of the land, because they have made you desolate and swallowed you up on every side, that you may be a possession unto the residue of the heathen, and ye be taken up in the lips of talkers, and are an infamy of the people. Therefore, ye mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord to the mountains, and to the hills, and to the rivers, and to the valleys, to the desolate wastes, and to the cities which are forsaken. Why are they forsaken? Which became a prey and a derision to the residue of the heathen that are round about. It is the Arabs round about that have wandered in and out of Palestine over the centuries that have desolated Palestine. An Arab historian in the 14th century spoke of the destruction of Palestine. He said the Arabs would come in and set up a tent next to a building. They wouldn't live in the building. They'd set up a tent next to the building and live in the tent. And they'd start tearing down the building and using it for firewood. It is a matter of history that it is the Arabs that have made Israel the waste and desolate land that it is. And this is what is referred to here. Verse 6, prophesy therefore concerning the land of Israel. Say unto the mountains and to the hills and to the rivers and to the valleys. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I have spoken in my jealousy and in my fury because they have borne the shame of the heathen. Then, verse 7, therefore, thus saith the Lord, I have lifted up my hand, surely the heathen that are about thee, they shall bear their shame. Yes, these Arab nations, these Bedouins, these Arabs that claim rootage in Israel for such a long period of time merely wandered in and out of the land according to the economic conditions of the Middle East, and they made the land a barren waste. But in verse 8, but O ye, O mountains of Israel, ye that shoot forth your branches, yield your fruit to my people of Israel, and for they are at hand to come. For behold, I am for you, and I will turn unto you, and ye shall be tilled and sown, and I will multiply men upon you and all the house of Israel, even all of it. And the city shall be inhabited, and the wastes places built. And I will multiply upon you man and beast, and they shall increase and bring forth fruit. And I will settle you after your own estate, and will do better unto you than at your beginnings. And ye shall know that I am the Lord. Yes, the only people that have been able to bring vitality to the land of Israel have been the Jewish people. And all Israel will be brought back. And the Arabs who have desolated the land will be put to shame. Zephaniah, the second chapter. It won't take time to read it, but read verses 8 and 9. And it speaks of a perpetual destruction that will come upon Moab and Ammon by Israel. A perpetual destruction likened to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. So there will be a decisive victory of the Israelites over the Jews, or rather the Israelites over the Arabs. And the question now raised in Zephaniah 2 is, will the territory of Moab be given back to the Arabs, and will the territory of Ammon be given back to the Arabs after the time of trouble is over? That's a question for you to answer. I quite doubt it myself. So we feel that we're zeroing in for the time for the churches to come to power, which will happen after the exodus of Russian Jews, after land is taken from Jordan. Then Babylon will come to power. The earthquake of Revelation 16, where the masses rise up, that will disintegrate into anarchy. The little flock will be taken. The great company will have their robes washed white. And then, remember Micah 5, who defeats the Assyrians when they come into the land, Russia and her associates? 7 shepherds, the glorified church. And 8 princes of men, the ancient worthies, 8 being symbolic of a new birth. The ancient worthies cannot come on the scene until the little flock and the great company are passed beyond the veil and the marriage is released to be paid to justice so that the resurrection of the ancient worthies can begin. Therefore, the invasion of God cannot begin until after Babylon is destroyed and the little flock and the great company are dealt with. And that's further on in the anarchy period. We want to close with
2 Corinthians 4. For the light afflictions which is but for a moment worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Brethren, we feel the time is very short. Where are your treasures? On earth, with the things that are seen. In the not too distant future, our homes, our clothes, our TVs, our cars, our VCRs, our earthly ties, even our family ties, will pass out of existence. Our fame, our popularity, our positions at work or in the world, our praise among the brethren, our positions in the brotherhood, will all come to an end. Things which can be seen are temporal. How far are we from the end? I think the lesson that I learned with Brother John Cusina, as you know, last year ago, and the experience of Brother Bob, we are all only a heartbeat away from our deliverance. That's how short. And not only will these temporal things be ended, but the difficult experiences will also end. Trials will end, but the likeness of Christ that is developed in us will last eternally. Pain will end, but the sympathy for others that we have gained through bearing this pain will enable us to be sympathetic to the world. Physically, some of us are very unattractive. Unfortunately, physical attractiveness seems to enhance our relationship even with the brethren, because we all make an effort to be very attractive when we come to the meeting. The physical unattractive and the handicap. This unattractiveness and the handicaps of blindness, of being lame, deaf, will come to an end. But you know, those that are unattractive and have handicaps, unbeknown to them, usually something beautifully is taking place in them. A quiet and humble spirit is being developed, a sensitive and gentle spirit. And this will last throughout eternity. Some of us, by nature, we're born very rough and crude. I'm one of them. By nature, we're not tender and warm and sympathetic. And oh, how we struggle to minimize these qualities so that they weren't hurt our brother. Well, soon these natural qualities will end. But the discipline of love that we have been exercising to try to control them will last eternally. Because of the fall, all of us have been born lonely. We are out of harmony with our fellow man and with ourselves. Now, this is why we crave the companionship of others so much. We can't stand being with ourselves. We need others. Some have sought to control this loneliness, or they've been forced, because others have neglected them, to turn to the Lord and the Lord alone. And they have learned to enjoy many hours in prayer with the Lord and many hours in studying His precious word. Because how does the Lord talk to you and I through His word? And they have developed a fellowship that when this loneliness soon ends with the end of all things, this present life. That fellowship that they had developed now in this life will continue on more intensely throughout eternity. Brother, where are your treasures? On earth, temporal wealth, popularity, a desire for positions and office? Or are you developing the principles of truth and righteousness that can only come through sacrificing our all in the Lord's service? It can only come by putting the Lord first before anything else and before anyone else.